Good morning, Shannon.
Good morning.
I think Shannon, you might be the only person on the call today.
Oh, really? Right
well,
now?
So far. Right now.
Yeah.
Right now. Hang on just a second. I've been having one major technical issue after another, and I just want to give me just a minute here before we start.
Yeah.
I've got to log into my website, which is responding really slowly to me this morning. Hang on a second. Sorry, I'm just going to really, just for some reason, this is not working. Hopefully this will work. This will give everybody else a minute to get on. Okay, that's not working. I don't know what's going on with that. All right, so I'm going to have to just go wing it here. All right, well, let's go ahead, Shannon, you and me, and we'll do our meditation for a few minutes, and maybe others will join us for this final call.
Okay.
All right. Well, actually, I think, good morning. I think there's a couple of us on now. And give me just a second. I want to try one more thing so I can get onto my mentorship page here, which is having some technical difficulty this morning. Oh, good. Here we go. All right. Sorry about that, everybody. I think that'll work now. So, Chrisandra and Shannon, it looks like the two of you are the only people on here today. And I've had some technical problems. In fact, it's still going on. And I don't seem to be able to get onto my mentorship page, so I can't read Dr. Carey's intake form. Are either of you online and have access to your mentorship page?
I can go online.
Oh, I'm sorry. I had you muted, Sharon, because there was Shannon, because there was background noise. Shannon, are you on yours by any chance?
I can get on mine.
Maybe if you both get online and get onto your mentorship page, because I think we're going to want to look at Dr. Carey's intake form, and what can happen is, it came. I've got it. Oh, isn't that great? But you might want to be on yours anyway, so you can follow along, because I think we'll do Dr. Carey's case today. So I've got that up, and we're doing the one that, it's I think it's the only active one up there.
Okay.
So anyway, you might want to go on to that, and you don't have to now that I've got mine. You can just follow along if you want. But the hard drive on my computer died last night. So I don't have certain things. Like, I don't have the notes that I took on the last class.
Okay.
And so I'm going to need your help a little bit in terms of letting me know. We were going to continue with thyroid information today. And I don't I've been talking about the thyroid in another group, too, so I'm not totally sure what we've covered and what we haven't covered, all right? And we were going to pick up, I think that all we had on the roster for today, and correct me if there's anything else you remember, is we were going to do Dr. Carey's case study and finish talking about the thyroid. I have some little thing in the back of my head that there was something else, but again, I don't have my notes anymore. Until I figure out my hard drive situation. So is there anything else that was on the list that anybody remembers?
That's what I remember from the call, but the call that I listened to was recorded and it stopped at, I don't know, there was another 12 minutes to go and I didn't hear the very end, but it sounded like that's where we were headed for this week.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it ended. I think there was a minute or two of dead space, and then it might have picked up again.
Okay.
All right. So, because I remember there being some little, like, people couldn't hear me for a minute or so,
okay.
So you might be able to get the end of that. I'll try to remember to look for that, but. We'll do the best we can, and if I start saying something that I already said, let me know, okay?
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. All right, so sorry about this. These things happen. Hard drive crashed, and using my husband's computer, and his Skype wasn't working. But anyway, all kinds of what could happen did happen this morning. So, no harm. And Carrie can't be on the call today because she had a flight change. So we're gonna I think what we'll do is I'm gonna try to remember and recap what we did last time with the thyroid, pick up from there, and then go through her case study best I can. So I think what we did with the case study last, what not with the case study, with the thyroid information last time, is go through. We talked about how it relates to the bucket syndrome, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to leave you all, I'd like to leave you all unmuted, but there is a little background noise. If you can make sure your background noise is as little as possible, and if someone has a lot, I'll mute you. But otherwise, I'd like to keep you unmuted so you can give me feedback about if we've already covered something or not.
You might as well mute me because there will be background noise in this.
All right.
Yeah, I have star 6 on mute if I have questions.
Okay, yeah, good. All right, perfect. Thanks. Okay, so Shannon's muted. So, Cassandra and Mary, if you can let me know if I'm jump in if I'm covering something I already covered. So I think that we talked about the thyroid in the context of the bucket syndrome going on too long, and if it goes on too long, first the adrenals get hit, and we talked about what that would look like. then the insulin-producing portion of the pancreas would get hit. We talked about what that would look like. And then the thyroid would get hit, and we talked somewhat about what that would look like. Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And did we talk about hypo and hyperthyroid and Hashimoto's?
Yeah, we did.
And okay, great. Good. Being on a scale of bad to worse. All right, good. So, and did we talk about did we give some herb mixes and talk about castor packs on the thyroid in terms of how to deal with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We did. Okay, good. All right, so that's where I thought we'd gone. What we didn't do, I think, is go through how the thyroid works in Western medicine some and how it's connected to the hypothalamus and the pituitary and the other organs in the body. Did we do that?
I don't think so.
Okay, I don't think so either. So good.
Yeah. My notes your herbal formula, actually.
What, Cassandra?
My notes end with, we talked about Graves' disease and Hashimoto's, but from there, I think we stopped.
Okay. Do you have an herb mix or no?
I do. You gave us an herbal formula.
Okay, great. Okay, good. So the reason I'm going to go into some of the Western stuff, and remember, I'm not a expert. I'm not an endocrinologist, right? So there's only so deep I can go into the Western stuff. But the Western stuff sometimes is so interesting to explore because it gives us actually an easier way to understand it from Eastern medicine, because we can start, it just gives us an extra ability to employ Nei Quan, the ability to see inside the body and see what's going on. Then that helps us feel what's going on and also helps us figure out how best to diagnose and treat, even from a point of view. So what I think would be helpful is if you had a piece of paper in front of you, is to draw a little diagram here and draw like a little pea-sized circle at the top of your diagram. That's the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus is, I can't believe it's so small. It's this little pea-sized gland that sits at the base of the brain and sort of in the middle of the body, in the base of, middle of the head at the base of the brain. And it's the king of the endocrine system. And you're all clear on what the endocrine system is, right? Can you hear me?
Sorry, yes.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so the hypothalamus is the king. So it's sort of the king of managing opposites in the body. And what's so cool about this is that it gives impulses and chemical messengers and so forth to different glands in the body for them to respond to the needs of the moment with the opposite thing. So thirsty, lets us know that we're thirsty, so we drink, and then we're satiated. It lets us know we're satiated. If we're too hot, it cools us down, all that kind of stuff. But the other cool thing about it is the input part of that. So the output part of the hypothalamus is it's making everybody else handle the opposites. But the input part is particularly interesting from the point of view of the 10 great vessels and the channel system of the mind and prana and rasa, in that the hypothalamus receives input from the heart and receives input from the five senses, from the skin, from the eyes, from the smell. It receives input from the five senses, from the heart, and as this feedback loop, like what's going on in the body will affect the hypothalamus. It will register that, and then it will make its delegation decisions accordingly. So I love that it receives from the 10 channels, basically, from the root of Rasa, Prana, and Manovaha, Srotha, the heart, and from the five senses, which are an integral part of the 10 channel system, the 10 great vessels, right? So the basically Rasa, Prana, and the mind are are giving feedback to the hypothalamus, and the hypothalamus is then directing the endocrine system accordingly. You follow?
Yes.
Yep.
Okay. All right. I'm going to just keep checking in with you a little bit. I want to make sure you're hearing me and we're clear. So that's what receives all the input. Then you've got your little pea-sized gland. You know, you could put a little arrow pointing down to another circle, which is the pituitary. And the pituitary gland takes the information from the hypothalamus and is another sort of grand central station. It receives information from the hypothalamus, and in terms of the thyroid, which is really our conversation today, the anterior portion of the pituitary gland receives information from the hypothalamus, and it's the pituitary gland that releases thyroid stimulating hormone to affect the thyroid. So whatever the hypothalamus tells the pituitary then knows how much to stimulate the thyroid gland. So then you've got another little arrow going down to the thyroid gland. And if you want to draw the thyroid gland, you could draw like a little butterfly shape, because that's the thyroid gland looks like a little butterfly. It has this dual nature to it, just like the lungs and the kidneys, right? There's sort of two parts. So it's the same on both sides. I'm having trouble with words today. But there's so this little butterfly, which is the thyroid. And the thyroid then produces two hormones that we'll talk about today, the T3 and T4. And what it does is it produces a ton of T4, compared to T3. And then T4 turns into T3. It becomes T3. So there's a lot less of T3, but T3 is a lot more concentrated. And I know this sounds all kind of complicated, but if we think about it in terms of the dhatus, and we think about the early dhatus like rasa and rukta being very, very plentiful, and the later dhatus like shukra dhatu as being not very plentiful, but very concentrated and life-giving, it's kind of like that. T4, it's plentiful, but it creates T3, which is a more concentrated, powerful little hormone. It's about five times more active, and T4, there's about 17 times T4 compared to T3. You following this?
Mm-hmm.
All right, and this is not the interesting part, but it's a setup. So what all this stuff is doing, what the thyroid is doing, and what T3 and T4 are doing is we could call the thyroid maybe the Tejas gland of the body, in the sense that it governs Agni in the body. It governs, it is like a go-between between the Bhuta Agnis and the Dhatu Agnis. The Dhatu Agnis are responsible for figuring out metabolism of the tissues, right? So if it's weak, it'll create too much tissue. If it's strong, it'll create too little tissue. You remember that with how we create the dhatus and the dhatu agnis?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So it's really the thyroid, the hormones that are responsible for this. So we could think in a sense of the hypothalamus and the pituitary and the thyroid in this way, in a sense, where the thyroid is, if we look at it from like a thermostat, the pituitary gland is a thermostat in a sense, and the thyroid is the heating system, and the hypothalamus is the person who turns the thermostat up or down. All right, in the body. So how hot does the Agni need to be? How powerful does it need to be? Is it too high? Is it too low? The hypothalamus will turn that thermostat as needed. The pituitary is like the thermostat itself, and the thyroid is like the heating system. Can you get a little visual with that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. So now So when people are talking about having hypo or hyperthyroid, the things we talked about last time, they find that out because of blood tests that show different levels of TSH, the thyroid stimulating hormone that is produced by that anterior portion of the pituitary, and the levels of T3 and T4. And you can have all different variations in terms of, is TSH too high or is it too low? Is T3 and T4, what's their relationship to TSH? And all of that stuff doesn't really matter for our purposes. Here's where the story to me gets really interesting. The Western way that we address the thyroid issues is if we're giving too much, we basically injure the thyroid so it won't produce too much, and if it's producing too little, we supply more of those hormones that it would produce. So that it almost seems to me like our goal in Western medicine is to get the blood work right, you know, to take blood samples and have T3 and T4 and TSH levels appropriate, and we want the blood work to come back with the right numbers, but it's not really healing the problem, and there's a reason for that even in Western medicine that we can see. And here is the piece that I really never hear talked about that to me seems really fascinating and really an argument for a holistic response to a local problem, the local problem being the thyroid, T3 and T4 and TSH levels being out of whack. And here's the thing. So T4, remember, is the more plentiful one, and that becomes T3. And where does it do that? Yes, it does it in the thyroid, but it also does it in other tissues and organs in the body. The brain, and I don't have the list in front of me because my hard drive crashed, but what I remember, and I think that this is comprehensive, is the brain and the gut, the skeletal muscles, and the liver and the kidneys, and especially the liver. So I'm going to say that again. T4 is transformed into T3, yes, in the thyroid, but also in the brain, in the gut, in the skeletal muscles, in the kidney, and especially in the liver. You got that? With me? Can you hear me?
Yeah. Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay, good. All right, so look how important that is. Suppose we have low T3 in our system, and that may be not anything to do. What it says, what this picture says to me is that that may not mean that the thyroid is weak. That may mean that the liver is weak, because the liver isn't and the liver is the main one of those of that list that turns T4 into T3. So this means if the liver function is not optimal, we are not, then the T4 is not going to get turned into T3, right? There's also this other component with the liver that's really important, and I forget all the names of these things, but there's a protein that the liver creates that binds to T3 and T4 and brings the T3, T4 to the tissues it needs to bring it to, and at those tissues, that protein falls off and activates T3, T4, something like that, right? So that's another way the liver is involved. So let's look at that. If the liver function is low, or if those proteins, those binding proteins, and proteins is like earth element, if the liver function is low, or the Bhuta Agnis are low, possibly especially for the earth element, right? Because there's a Bhuta Agni for each of the elements. So if that earth element Agni is low, that protein, that binding protein, might not be created appropriately. Maybe it'll create it in a bad way. And I'm hypothesizing here because the liver, we see the same thing with cholesterol, I think, and with good estrogen and bad estrogen. The liver is responsible for creating good or bad estrogen. Why would it ever create bad estrogen? It's responsible for creating good cholesterol or bad cholesterol. Why would it ever create anything but something optimal? And the only reason I can think of is that the liver function is not optimal. It's sub-optimal. It's not optimal. And the Bhuta Agnis are a big part of that. So if the Bhuta Agnis are low, then T4 can't turn into T3 as efficiently as it should, and then we are going to end up having low Dhatu Agni. Do you follow how that is?
Yeah.
Right? It's kind of a complicated picture from one point of view, but the simple picture, if we back up and look at this, if we've got our little diagram with the pea-sized hypothalamus, and then we've got the pituitary, and then we've got this nice little butterfly thyroid, what you can do then is put in a bunch of little arrows, one that goes to the brain, one that goes to the gut, one that goes to the skeletal muscles, one that goes to the liver, one that goes to the kidney. All of a sudden, what you see is a much bigger picture than a little gland problem. This is why when you're treating the thyroid, it's so complicated in a sense, because you can't just treat the thyroid. You have to look at where the problem is coming from. Is it coming from the brain? Is it coming from the gut, from the skeletal muscles, from the liver, or from the kidney? And we especially want to pay attention to the liver, where a big part of this happens. So in any situation that we have in the body, in any time we've got a problem in an organ or a gland, and I may have mentioned this last time, we've got two possible ways that we can treat that. We can treat it directly, the organ or the gland directly, or we can treat it back up and treat it holistically. So that, because if we back up and treat it holistically, we take the pressure off the gland or the organ, because everything else is working optimally. So it's not, so the weak link is being protected. And so if we look at this in terms of the thyroid, if the liver function is low, then absolutely that's going to put a strain on the thyroid system, right? On the Agni system, on how well the Dhatu Agnis are working. So I know Dr. Lodd has talked about the thyroid being the bridge between Bhuta Agnis and Dhatu Agnis, and from sort of a Western point of view, this is why, because all of the organs, especially the liver, have a part to play with it. It's almost like the organs and the thyroid are the bridge between Dhatu Agni and Bhuta Agnis, right? Because we've got Jatara Agni, which is responsible for turning these raw elements in terms of raw food that we're eating or cooked food, whatever, which is the raw elements we're bringing in. Jatara Agni turns that into a more refined, usable product, and then that circulates through the body, and everything runs through the liver. The Bhuta Agnis further refine all of those things down into further refined biological substances, including T3 and T4, including estrogen, including cholesterol. All this happens in the liver, right? And so the thyroid is sort of a bridge between the two, but it's so integral. It's almost like they're the same system, right? It's the same system. So you've just got to back up, and you've got to look at the entire body and see where the problems are that are not in the thyroid, to take the pressure off the thyroid, to have the feedback information that's going back to the hypothalamus affect the pituitary and then affect the thyroid. I know that's a lot, but do you get that the main thing is to get the holistic picture that the thyroid is not standing alone, that it's working with these other organs and tissues in the body, and we've got to look at those and not only the thyroid. Does that make sense? Can you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right, perfect. So if we think about the thyroid as sort of the active manager of Agni, And I think that's all I wanted to say about that. So, you know, I remember Dr. Carrie just emailed me yesterday and said she wouldn't be here today, and she was really curious about the connection between, I think she said, the thyroid and bone density. And I'd have to say that we'd have to look at it in the same way that we would look at the thyroid and any tissue density. If the Dhatu Agni is low, we can assume that T3 and T4 are not optimal, and that then the Dhatu Agni is either going to be low or high, and this is for any tissue, including bone. And then we just have to look. We want to probably look first at the liver, actually, and see how the Bhuta Agnis are doing, and work with them, because if they're working well, it's going to take the pressure off the thyroid. If we're going to deal with it locally, we can do the things we talked about last time. We can do the castor oil packs on the thyroid maybe 3 times a week for about a half an hour, not with any extra heat. We can do the kind of herb mix that we talked about. We'd really want to look at how the liver is doing and possibly do liver herbs to support that, but we'd really have to see what the problem was, right? Is it that earth and water elements aren't being transformed well enough, or what is the problem with the liver, and address it in a holistic way. So I think that it sort of ends the long stuff I wanted to talk about the thyroid directly, and what we can do is sort of try to apply this to Carrie's case study. And since she's not here, she won't be able to fill in some of the gaps for us, but we can try to do that. Mick, any questions? Okay. All right, so I'm going to pull up Carrie's case study. A young woman with whole body alopecia. So alopecia is hair loss. So she doesn't have hair on her whole body. And I really want to get your input on this. What would be the first thing you would? I have not looked over this case study, but what would be the first thing you would think of if there was a problem with the hair on the body? Are you there?
Yes.
All right. You know, I'm going to unmute you too, Shannon. Just want to hear what you're thinking about. What you would think about with that?
I would think about the bones first.
You would, right? Exactly. And so why?
Because the hair and nails are related to the bones, or the mala, right?
Exactly. And so then why would we have too little of, not the mala, I think, but is it the upadhatu?
Would that be too much dhatu agni if there's too little?
Right, exactly. It could be too, yeah, it's, I mean, that's what I would think of, is that the Asti Dhatu Agni is low, creating too much, you know, of the related tissues. If it's low, it's creating too much of the related tissue. Sorry,
right.
So it's high.
Right.
So high, creating too little, right? So that's what I would think of. But one way or another, I would not come to that conclusion yet, because I would also want to see if Asti Dhatu Agni was too high and creating too little hair, then we would we expect her to be heavy or thin?
Thin.
Right. Because why?
Because if any time the Agni is high, then it would be creating less tissue, not more.
Right. And Medha, right? Medha feeds Asti, right? They're very related. So Medha feeds Asti. And so if there's not enough Medha, there may not be enough Asti as well. So it could be something like that.
Right.
So let's see. This woman is 5'7", and she's 142 pounds. So that doesn't sound like she's really underweight, really, to me. That sounds like she might be about right. What do you think?
Yeah, that just doesn't sound underweight.
All right. So you know, this is just, I'm just sharing my process with you from top to bottom. I haven't looked this over, but I would wonder if she was underweight or overweight. That looks like it may not be an issue. She's 35 years old. She's an IT department manager, oversees other managers for an international company. That to me says stress. We don't know because Carrie's not here to answer that, but if you're a department manager overseeing other managers for an international company, that sounds, one of my first questions for her would be, how many hours a week do you work and is it stressful? The reason that I'm interested in that is because if the bucket syndrome has gone on too long, then it's going to affect the thyroid, right?
Right.
And that's going to affect the Dhatu Agnis. And so it seems to me, if there's no hair, that the Dhatu Agni is affected. Now, one of the things I've noticed, even though theoretically, if you have less Upadhatu or Mala associated with the with whatever Dhatu we're talking about, theoretically, it's always because the Agni is too high, creating too little. But it doesn't always seem to work like that. Sometimes if the Dhatu Agni is too low, even though theoretically if Dhatu Agni is too low, you create excess tissue or excess Upadhatu or Mala. It's only a theory. And sometimes it'll go the other way. And maybe that's because the reduced Agni is not allowing for development at all of a tissue. And so then there's not enough tissue that way too. Does that make sense? So this is where we start getting like clinical, actually your clinical experience may deviate from the theory. And so you don't want to stick to the theory if you can, you know, you want to try to explain it because all of these theories aren't reality. They're trying to explain reality. So what I would be thinking of, because she's got no hair on her body, which is theoretically because of high Dhatu Agni, Asti Dhatu Agni probably, it's only theory, and since she doesn't seem like she's underweight, I would question that theory, and I would think, but I would still keep to, there's a problem with Asti Dhatu Agni. I don't know what that problem is. It's either too high or too low, or it's just whacked out in some way, and so that's the only thing that I feel fairly confident to say at this point. And it may not matter because if we can support the whole system to get the Agni better, we'll see if there's other indication. We're looking at this point, are there indications that Agni's too low or too high, or can we even figure that out? You follow?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So, all right. So hair loss. She had for the first time in 2000. A recurrence in 2009, saw Dr. Carey in 2011, it grew back, and a recurrence of hair loss in 2012 with unable to regrow. So this is getting worse and worse, right? This is getting, since it's now unable to grow back, it's worse. She was diagnosed with hypothyroidism since 2000, Graves' disease, and she's stable on current medication. So this is interesting, right? Because Graves is more of the hyper, then it goes into Hashimoto's, and then it goes into hypothyroid. So I'd sort of want to ask Carrie what was going on here. But in terms of, did she have Graves' disease first, or does she have Graves' disease now along with the hypothyroidism? But in any case, from my point of view, it almost doesn't matter. If there was hypothyroidism, that's kind of usually, unless there's a really strong family history, and we don't know that in this case, if there's a really strong family history and someone is really young and their thyroid just conks out, you know, and they haven't had a chance, you know, it'll happen to like maybe women in their 20s or their 30s. Like, it's too early to have your thyroid totally conk out on its own. If there hasn't been a history of stress, I'm gonna think that that's a really strong genetic component. Otherwise, I'm gonna think if it's hypo, my guess is that it's usually been hyper first, and the thyroid is burned out, and now it's become hypo. So this, to me, seems like, since this has been going on for 14 years, and she's been hypothyroid since 2000, it's possible that this is irreversible damage, that that this is that she will need to be on medication for the rest of her life. Is there hope? Yeah, there's always hope, but is there hope to turn this completely around and heal it? There's hope. You might as well work towards it, but time will tell, and it remains to be seen if this is something that falls into the curable category or the not curable but manageable category, or, you know, manageable with difficulty or not manageable, right? So it sounds to me like this is probably going to be a manageable case, maybe not curable, but certainly manageable. And how we manage that might have to include Western medication. Following all that?
Yeah.
All right. So yeah. This is just going through, you know, my thought process going through this. So I'm going to just keep moving through. So then she says, in 2000, she found out Dad had been cheating on her mom. He said he would admit it to family, but didn't, and she couldn't speak about it. Okay, so she found out about her dad's cheating, and he apparently told her that he would tell the family, but he didn't, and she wasn't able to speak about it. All right, so that's pretty important. Why? What makes you think that might be important?
The thyroid's in the throat.
Right, and she can't speak about it. And so there gets to be stagnation in the throat, in the prana, in the throat. And women have a tendency, remember, to have prana stagnate most in one of three places: the reproductive system, the chest, especially the breast, and the throat. And this is one of the reasons I think that the thyroid could, has a huge tendency to get stuck. So when I hear this, all right, so I've got two things going on now. Like, has she had an enormous amount of stress in her life that has made the bucket syndrome go on so long that it's reached the thyroid? And now it's sort of like, well, maybe there's this other component where there was this stagnation because she couldn't speak about something. So I've just got it all as maybes in my head at this point, and not going further than that, just, you know, it's all kind of all right. Is the Dhatu Agni low or high? Has there been long-term stress? And has there been stagnation in the throat? And so far, we don't know about whether the Dhatu Agni is low or high or what's going on with that. We're not really sure if there's been long-term stress. I would suspect there is because of her job. And there also may be because of this business of her not being able to talk about her father's affair. And certainly there's stagnation, most likely. So that's all we've got so far, and we go on. And she says these problems don't impair her daily activities. She wears a wig and takes a thyroid replacement. Ideally what's going to happen is that this will absolutely impair her daily activities, in that she may need to depend, if this is truly because of long-term terrific stress, then the cure is long-term terrific rest in big part, along with looking at how her Dhatu Agnis are functioning. She's seen lots of healthcare professionals for this, an endocrinologist, a naturopathic doctor, an acupuncturist for 4 months. She's had whole body numbness in 2006, and the doctor thought she had MS, but she has no symptoms now, except tired from heat. She gets tired with heat. Her marriage was untenable and ended, and symptoms resolved. Not quite that tidy. Okay, sounds like there's more picture in here, more story in here than we quite know. But when we look at whole body numbness, which Dhatu or which Sratamfi are we going to think about with that? Did someone say Maja?
Yeah.
Good, because that's exactly right. So, and that would seem to be a very important symptom. So we've got Ashti Dhatu involved, and we've got Majavaha Srotas. And why do I say Majavaha Srotas instead of Maja Dhatu? Anybody? All right. So the reason why I would say Majavaha Srotas is involved and not Maja Dhatu is that if it was you could say Maja Dhatu, and you wouldn't be wrong, but Maja Vahasrotas lets us know that it's a systemic thing. It's not just the nervous tissue in one part of the body. I mean, you could say that. You could say that it's the nervous tissue. It certainly involves. But by bringing the attention to the srot, by adding srotas onto there, Maja Vahasrotas instead of Dhatu, is you know the Dhatu is involved. But you know the whole Maja system is involved. And how do we know that that it's systemic? Because she has whole body numbness. It's not like she's got tingling in one part of her body and her nerves are affected there. So I think it's most elegant to say that it's the whole srotas system. You could say, you know, vata in Maja Vahasrotas or something like that. But at this point, we just know that it's involved. The Maja Vahasrotas is involved. Asti Vahasrotas is involved, and the Dhatu Agnis may be involved, right? I'm curious about her bone density, but I don't know if we're going to get that information. We'll see. Her marriage was untenable. That suggests stress to me. I don't know how long she was married and how problematic things were, but there's another little check in the stress box. So please check if you've ever had any of the following. She's had anemia. I'd be really interested in that, why she has anemia. Does she have anemia because she simply is undernourished? Is she not eating well? Is it because, I mean, there's many different kinds of anemia, and one kind of anemia has to do with the kidney function being impaired somewhat because erythropoietin, EPO, that Lance Armstrong drug, that's a hormone that's created in the kidneys that tells the bone marrow to create blood. So if the kidneys are functioning subpar, that could also be a problem. But we don't know why she has anemia. So just sharing thought process, which is kind of all I can do at this point without Carrie being here. I'm just kind of going through my thought process when I hear these things. So then she's checked thyroid or goiter trouble, which we know. She says she used to get migraines regularly, and now they're rare, and her voice is raspy. Her voice being raspy, so migraines, we don't know enough about that. We can't ask her about were they with her periods, and where were they on her head, and the things that would help us understand that. And they're rare now, so I'm going to kind of put that off the table. Her voice being raspy also is an indication to me of some kind of stagnation in the throat. So I'm really starting to think, all right, she's got this raspy voice. She's got this throat. The stagnation in the throat is really important. I bet she would respond well to castor oil packs on her throat, three times a week, something like that, along with looking at the rest of the body, and especially the Bhuta Agnis. So her meals, breakfast, oatmeal, kashi or granola bar, and yogurt. Granola bar, I mean, I would rather see her definitely be eating whole foods. So oatmeal, I don't know where she lives, but if she lives in a hot environment, yogurt might be okay. If she lives in a cold environment, it takes Agni a little while to wake up in the morning. So yogurt first thing in the morning might be squashing her Agni, and we really want to care about the condition of her Agni. We also really want to know what her digestion is like, any gas, bloating, or heartburn, and any loose stools or constipation, and we don't know those pieces of information here. But that would let us know, that would help us to understand whether Agni was low or high overall. She usually eats lunch out at work, pasta, panini, wrap, or turkey and burger, and maybe some soup. Supper is not much if she's not hungry. Soup with toast. She loves baked goods twice a week. You know, not a terrible diet, but not terrific. And we'd need to know her digestive symptoms in order to know how to tweak that, in order to know whether to help her increase her Agni or see if it was already too high. So we don't know yet. She's taking a whole bunch of supplements, including a yin nourishing herbal formula. Since we don't really have all the information we need for this case in terms of what's going on with her digestive system, this gives us a hint, because whoever she's seeing in terms of an acupuncturist is giving her a yin nourishing herbal formula. So they have questioned her, presumably, on her digestion and so forth, and seen other things that we haven't been able to see. And they've determined that she needs extra yin. So if she needs extra yin, that indicates that, you know, that she's probably got high vata, and because yin is a very, you know, yin nourishing is a very vata soothing sort of thing. So it sounds like she's got stagnation in the throat and she's had high vata for a long time. We could just, you know, that it could be as simple as that. And if we didn't even get more complicated and we just tried to deal with that, we could possibly help her a fair amount. She has a family history of epilepsy, high blood pressure, and stroke. And that doesn't give me a lot of information, except that her thyroid is not checked. So she doesn't have a family history of thyroid disease. So the good news about this case, and Carrie, when you listen to this later, the good news is that she doesn't have a family history with this. So it should be more easy to turn around. And it gives us an enormous amount of information. That the fact that she doesn't have thyroid disease in her family lets us know two things. One, it's easier to turn around. Two, she has had to do something clearly in her life to create this problem. In other words, and the two things would be a lot of stagnation in the throat area, the throat chakra kind of thing, the bucket syndrome going on for too long. And it has to be clear. It's not like, oh, I've had a little stress in my life, but it's not much. You have to have had a lot of stress to kill your thyroid like this. And it sounds like it's been pretty smashed, right? And I wouldn't use those words, of course, with her. But it's really, you know, to have it be hypo for 14 years, it's been really smushed. So something in her life and her diet, not her family's history, has done this. Now, and of course, I don't mean by that that her family unit has not contributed to this, because of course, it sounds like there was dysfunction in the family, and that could have been extremely stressful, and she could have inherited this from her family, but not genetically, right? She could have just inherited it from her family emotionally and so forth. She has abdominal pain or cramping with menstruation, pretty moderate amount. That's indicating some stagnation in the reproductive area, and heavy bleeding with her period, which is also an indication of stagnation in the reproductive area. So she may do very well to do castor oil packs on her uterus, on the reproductive area, on the lower abdomen. And now what this says to me is, remember, when women have a tendency to stagnation, it happens in one of three places: the reproductive organs, the chest, especially the breast, and the thyroid. And she's got two out of three. This would make me ask about her breast health. I would ask her, does she have any fibrocystic changes or lumps in her breast? And I would be really vigilant about massaging her breasts with castor oil if there's any lumps, and with maybe Banyan's breast balm if there are no lumps. But she needs to, she is a woman prone to stagnation, is what it's looking like to me, because of the stagnation, clear signs of stagnation in the throat and in the reproductive tissue. That makes me really concerned for her breast health, in terms of preventative care for her breast health. And that's all the information we have from her study. So from this information, I would look more into the digestive area, because remember too, one of the places where T4 turns into T3 is in the gut. So so I'm looking at the gut and the liver, and possibly the kidneys as well, because if the kidney, in terms of why she's got anemia. So Carrie, when you listen to this, consider why she has anemia. Are the kidneys affected somewhat? Is EPO being affected? How is her Agni in terms of her digestive system? And does she have Munda, Tikshna, or Vishama Agni? Look at that. And if there's nothing obvious in terms of her digestive system, you really want to look at, I think that the liver is going to be a huge component here. Now, I think we've talked about this before, but it's such a beautiful way of looking at the liver. The Chinese medical system really focuses on organ health, and so they have a beautiful way of looking at each organ system. And the liver organ system in Chinese medicine, they look at the liver as what they call it is the free and easy wanderer, and it's responsible for the free and easy flow of prana or qi in the body and in the mind. So anytime we have anxiety, it clamps down our liver. When the other organs get weak, they get flaccid, but when the liver gets weak, it astringes, it tightens. And that tightening of the liver, the way I look at that is that Agni in general works very well with space. In other words, if we're clamped down, there's not space for transformation. I mean, think about even emotional transformation we've had in our lives. And when we feel clamped, we don't get that emotional transformation. When we have space, it can just happen. And so when we're anxious or concerned and we go, and we tighten down and clamp down, that clamps the prana down in the body, and that clamps the liver down, and the Bhuta Agnis are impaired. It could be that simple with this woman. It's probably not, because I think that the stagnation in the throat is having a big part of this. But if we can open up space, I would work with opening up space for this woman, for her Agnis to improve, right? So space in the throat, doing the dissolving obstructions track, really focusing on the throat part of that track. But also, you know, the torso part, you know, the whole torso, opening the space in the torso too, and in the liver, because if we can create some space in there, then Agni can have space to transform things. So I would look at the gut in terms of Japa Agni. I'd look at the liver in terms of the Bhuta Agnis and treat those accordingly. I would use castor oil packs on the lower abdomen, castor oil packs on the thyroid, but of course in different ways. The thyroid without added heat, and only for about a half an hour, three times a week. And for her, it's not massive cramps, but it's fairly regular. I would probably do 3 to 5 times a week for an hour and a half, castor oil packs on her lower abdomen, not when she's having her cycle, not when she's bleeding, but otherwise for maybe 3 months. And work with her diet to support the Agni, the healthy Agni. And we don't know, is the Agni too high or too low? We don't really know that. But that's what we know, is we know we can work systemically to affect the thyroid, and we can work directly on the thyroid. In this case, both of them. I would assume that bucket syndrome has gone on a long time, and that there's stagnation in her throat, and that there might be some Agni stuff with her diet. But she also, if her diet is perfect and she still can't digest, it's because she's stressed, because we can't digest anything when we're stressed out. So we don't have Carrie here, but did that make sense to all of you?
Yeah.
Can you hear me? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
All right. So do you feel like you have a sense of the nature of the thyroid and how we might go about addressing it now?
Yeah, much more so.
All right, good.
Can I ask a question, Dr. Claudia?
Yes, please. We've got a half an hour, and we're done with our job. So it's up to you guys now. Like, let's see where we go. So definitely, question.
Can you talk about your process at how you when you're looking at the other organs that, you know, influence what's going on with the thyroid, so you're looking
right
at it holistically.
Right.
Why did we go more towards liver than kidney, for example?
Right. Okay, that's a really good question. The main reason is because the liver is the main organ that, of all of those, that transforms T4 into T3. It has the biggest job, because it's also, for two reasons. One, apparently because it's the main place that does that, and two, because it also is responsible for doing that carrier protein thing, that binding protein thing. So it's the most likely, it's the most important organ in terms of the thyroid. So it's, and so then for me, I think it could be any one of these for this woman, right? It's since it's the most important one in terms of transforming T4 to T3, it catches my attention faster, specifically in relation to the thyroid. So that's the only reason, really. But the other thing is that if I suspect that she has had the bucket syndrome go on for a long time, there's both the liver and the kidneys are, I think both of the liver and the kidneys, and I didn't talk about the kidneys too much. Let's talk about this a little more. I think both of them, and I didn't bring it up because the reasons are kind of Chinese medically, but it's really kind of interesting, actually. So why would we look at the liver first, and why would we look at the kidneys? We'd look at the liver because of the Bhuta Agnis, and that's super important, right? You get why that's important.
Yeah.
Okay. So so that's why I'd look at the liver. I'd think that anytime somebody has the bucket syndrome going on long enough, we assume that there's been a lot of stress. When there's stress, the liver astringes. That's what happens. It just, because it's the responsible for the free and easy flow of emotion, it works both ways. When the liver is astringed and functioning subpar, prana tends to stagnate more in the body. And it works the other way. When prana stagnates in the body, when we go, it astringes the liver, and then that affects the Bhuta Agnis. So this is why stress, in my opinion, why stress is why someone can have a really pretty decent diet and still have high cholesterol because of the stress, because the liver is astringing and not creating space for those Bhuta Agnis to really... Okay.
Hello? Hello.
Can we lose the audio?
Hello.
I think we lost her.
Okay. Is everyone else still here?
I'm still here.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. I guess we just wait.
Okay. Sorry, you lost me, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm back. For some reason, I just cut out. I'm actually, some of you got on late and may not have heard my hard drive crashed, and how I'm piecing this call together this morning is crazy. So it's amazing. It's working as well as it is. Okay, so did you get that, Chrisandra, about the liver? Basically, when it astringes, prana doesn't move well in the body. When prana doesn't move well in the body, it astringes. Both ways,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that's the liver thing. And that's why everybody has low liver energy when you feel their pulse or liver qi stagnation. The kidney, let's look at the kidneys. This is such a cool, important part of physiology, I think. And it's not really spelled out beautifully in Ayurveda. All right. The kidneys in Chinese medicine are said to be the root of yin and yang. Have we talked about that before?
Yeah. I think at some point with you. I don't know if we've talked about it here.
All right. So let's talk about it a little bit.
Okay.
All right. They're the root of yin and yang. And sometimes I've heard in Chinese medicine people say that the left kidney is the root of yang, opposite of Ayurvedic left and right business, and that the right is the root of yin. But I don't believe that. I don't believe that. Here's what I think is going on. I've heard Dr. Laud say before that the kidneys and the adrenals are the same organ system in Ayurveda. I haven't seen actually a word for adrenals in Ayurveda, but there's the word yakrut for kidney, and Dr. Laud has talked about those sort of as together. And certainly in Chinese medicine, the adrenals and the kidneys are sort of considered together. And they really are. In physiology, like the adrenals are these little thumb-sized glands that sit right on top of the kidneys, one on each kidney. So they're really the same organ in a sense. And if we look at the adrenals as being the root of yang, the root of lungana, it makes perfect sense, the root of stimulating and motivating, because they pump out the stress hormones, right? They pump out adrenaline and cortisol. They're the root of yang, the root of lungana, motivating, stimulating, lightening. And the body of the kidneys away from the adrenals, the body of the kidneys themselves, makes so much sense as being the root of brahmana in a way, because what is the representation of brahmana in the body in a big way? Blood. And we've seen today, right, the EPO, the erythropoietin, that is this messenger that goes to the thigh bones, especially to the marrow, but especially the marrow and the thigh bones, which is and tells them to produce blood. So the kidney organ itself is responsible for the production of blood, and the adrenals are responsible for the production of stimulating and motivating. What a better way to look at the root of yin and yang in the body, the root of lungana and brahmana. And so what Chinese medicine says about the kidneys is that they're the reserve organs. When you outspend your resources, you pull more from your kidney energy, right? So when we are feeling nervous energy, we've outspent our regular energy, and we're drawing on nervous energy. We're asking the adrenals to pump out some stress to stimulate us, because our regular energy isn't motivating us and stimulating us enough. And when we don't have enough blood, the kidneys send out more EPO to let our marrow know that we need to create blood. Now, when we bring this into into how beautifully this relates to Ayurveda, and Vata's main sites is the waist, right? And another is the thighs, because it has this big bone in it. But also, I think when we look at the kidneys are situated in the waist, right? You all know where they are. They're in the top of the waist, in the back. And when the kidney energy gets low, sometimes the kidneys can start to ache, or the low back aches, and we start thinking, "Oh, this is a Vata thing." And why would it be a Vata thing? Because when we get stressed out, it overstimulates the adrenals. It makes us tired. Vata crashes. And so the stress, which is high Vata, is affecting the kidneys, which is in the waist area, right? And the kidneys have this relationship to the marrow, to the thigh bones. So the kidneys and the thighs are really related. And when we... I don't want to get too complicated with that, but there's a little bit of that kind of connection. So with the thyroid issue, and with why I would look at the liver or the kidneys, is I would look at the kidneys, and I'd look them at the both almost from the same way. Like, if the person has gone through the bucket syndrome for long enough, I assume that they've outspent their resources long enough. Every time we outspend our resources, we dig into the kidneys to produce more, to give us what, to keep us going, and so the kidney energy gets weak, and so I would assume that the kidney energy is going to be affected if someone has gone through the bucket syndrome for long enough. Similarly, if they've gone through the bucket syndrome for long enough, I'm going to assume that their energy is
is clamped and tight. And if it's clamped and tight, the liver is going to astringe. And so I'm going to assume, if the Buckett syndrome has gone on long enough, probably both the liver and the kidneys are going to be affected. So both of them. And which one more? It's hard to say. I would probably think that they're both massively affected. How could you even imagine someone going through the Buckett syndrome long enough and with these criteria and with what we know about the kidneys and the liver now, how could they not be involved? They will be involved. And if we go through the rest of that list, right, the gut and the brain make a lot of sense to me, and we can talk about the skeletal muscles in a minute, but if the gut is responsible for turning T4 into T3, we just look at Jataragni and the state of digestion. Is there any gas, bloating, heartburn, loose stools, constipation? If so, we've got to deal with the gut. If the Buckett syndrome is going on long enough, whenever the Buckett syndrome is going on, we can't digest well. Because why? Because remember, cortisol is like this allocator, and it shunts prana and blood from the vital organs in the torso to the quads so that we can run away, and to the biceps so that we can fight. And so then we've got our resources, our prana and our blood out in our extremities, and we can't digest very well. And so we can't transform T4 into T3 in our guts very well, because we can't transform anything in our guts very well. So we really know the gut is involved if we have any signs of low Agni, any gas, bloating, heartburn, loose stools, constipation. If we have any of that, we can assume that the gut is involved. And you could be eating a perfect diet. So you look at the diet and you look at the Buckett syndrome. If the diet is wrong, fix it. If the Buckett syndrome is wrong, that's more complicated, because why has this person been going through stress for so long? And this is where we have to find the MF, the motivating factor. What is making them live a life they don't want to be living for so long, so intensely? And that takes a longer time to turn around, but it's the root cause. So that's the gut aspect of things. The brain aspect of things on that list of tissues that transform T4 into T3, the brain aspect for me, I just think about the 10 great vessels, right? Because, and I think about it, all right, the brain tissue itself transforming T4 and T3, I don't know about that so much. As the reason I think about the brain being so involved is because it's giving feedback to the hypothalamus about how to control everything. And the hypothalamus gets its information from the 10 great vessels in the heart. It does. It gets it from, you know, from which is basically what? It's basically the combination of rasa, prana, and the mind, the channels for rasa and prana and the mind. So that's a feedback thing. So the brain thing is a little more complicated in that, I don't know about, is it the brain tissue? I don't know enough about the physiology of how T4 is turned into T3 in the brain. But the brain, to me, I just can't help but associate with the channel system of the mind. And I know that the channel system of the mind gives feedback to the hypothalamus. So I would look at how this person is using their senses, how they're using their sensory organs. Do you remember the terms for Mitya yoga, Ati yoga, Hina yoga, where, you know, of the senses, where you're either overusing them, you're underusing them, or you're misusing them? Do you remember those terms?
Yeah,
right. So I would look at that. I would look at is this patient's senses, are they being underused, overused, or misused, and how so? But mostly, everybody, I mean, again, we're going to have to go back to, you know, the experienced practitioner uses one treatment for 100 different patients who walks through the door. For any one of these things, if the Buckett syndrome is going on long enough, it's going to affect any of them. And if we look at the skeletal muscles as, you know, that's kind of an interesting thing. You know, the skeletal T4 is changed to T3 in the skeletal muscles. To me, the interesting thing about that, and I don't know, again, the physiology of how it does that in the skeletal muscles, but it's the skeletal muscles where the blood and prana go to when we're under stress. So there might be a component there, right? There might be a component where if there's too much resources going there and getting stagnant, maybe the T4 doesn't turn to T3 well enough. I don't know about physiology well enough. But look, all of these things all of these things, the skeletal muscles, the gut, the brain, the liver, and the kidneys, they will all be affected by the bucket syndrome. And so while all of this is complicated and there's lots of little things going on in different places in all of these systems, and there's ways to look at all of these systems, the first thing we want to do is take the pressure off of all of these systems and get prana flowing smoothly. So we all know, you all know, without knowing all of the reasons why the thyroid gets screwed up, and it gets screwed up because of the liver and the kidneys and the skeletal muscles and the gut and the brain, and, you know, all of these things, without knowing that, it doesn't matter if we know that we've got to take care of the root cause. We've got to turn the bucket syndrome around, and we've got to move stagnation. And remember, in the Healthier Hormones course, when I talk about, you know, there's a few things that go wrong in male physiology, right? And there's so many things that go on in female physiology, and it feels so complicated and so huge. But it all boils down to two things. The bucket at the root of almost everything that I ever see. And I'm making this up, but I've made it up for a long time, and it keeps being reinforced by my experiences. There's two main syndromes that underlie women's problems: the bucket syndrome going on for too long, and stagnation. And in Carrie's case today, both were clear, it seemed to me, clearly going on. So anyway, that more that goes into more, I think, than you were bargaining for, Cassandra. But does the talk about the liver and kidneys make sense now?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. One of the things I want to mention about that relationship between the kidneys and the blood. So the kidneys produce EPO. That tells the marrow in the femurs especially, but the marrow to produce red blood cells and white blood cells, both. You know, so in a sense, rasa and rakta, right? If you think about white blood cells as being part of, and really, rasa is not just chyle or plasma. It's really not. It's really the liquid cooling part of the body. And, you know, blood, you end up getting a little bit richer and more concentrated. But the white blood cells and red blood cells, what I want to get to is that we think of them as yin. We think of them as highly nourishing in Brahmana, and they are. But one of the reasons I think that the thighs are connected to prana, right, is which is the healthy form of vata, in a sense, right, is because of how incredibly intelligent these cells are, these blood cells. We think of them as just going around. We almost think of the Brahmana stuff as being dumb, like structure and blobular stuff in the body, and you know, it's nourishing, but we don't understand, we don't get how intelligent these blood cells are. And one of the things that strikes me with this is, like, you get white blood cells circulating in the body, you get an infection somewhere, inflammation somewhere, you get a cut on your forearm and you get an infection there. The white blood cells are going through your vessels. What they can do is they can migrate outside of the vessels and go to that inflammatory area, deal with it, and then migrate back into the vessels. I mean, to me, when I think about that, that is profoundly intelligent and wild that these blood cells will go out of the vessel and back in. Did you find that crazy? Anybody?
Yeah.
Right?
How do they
Because they're intelligent, because prana is intelligent. And And so this intelligence of prana, there's so many examples of how crazy intelligent it is. That's just one of them. But then when we think, there's so many things, and there's so many things that can go awry with the intelligence of the body and with how things line up and how things present themselves. And when that happens, it's, again, one treatment for 100 different patients. I think, what is going wrong with the intelligence of the body? What is going wrong with prana, and how can we reset it? And, Carrie, when you listen to this later, that's definitely in my mind about your alopecia patient, because something has gone wrong, right? Which is the other, it is another possibility, right, in terms of the alopecia, is one is that there's an Agni component, and that's probably true, and one is that the intelligence of the body has gone awry, and that's probably also true. And so, is everybody still here? Can you hear me still?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, good. I just got concerned for a second, but all right. So whenever we consider that the possibility that the intelligence of the body has gone awry, I want to look at the root of the pranavahasrotas, which is the heart and the 10 great vessels, and I want to affect those. And so alternate nostril breathing, and this is why there's that guy I'm sure I've told you about, who I always talk about, this example of the guy with vitiligo in India, who did 2 hours of pranayama a day, 2 hours of nadi shodhana a day for 6 months, and it went away. Why? No idea, except that it realigned the intelligence of the body, the prana of the body, because it's affecting the heart, right? It's affecting the 10 great channels. We're working with Ida and Pingala to affect the heart and the 10 great vessels. And what are we doing with that? We're resetting the body's intelligence. And I just want to give a few more little examples of how delicate that body's intelligence is. One of the things that I didn't talk about on our Ayurvedic embryology course, but this really strikes me, is, and I should have talked about it at the beginning, is preconception. And I've talked about this to some degree, and I wish I'd talked about it more. And in Balance Your Hormones, Balance Your Life, and if I do a second edition, I will talk about it more. But is that 3 to 4 months before we conceive, before a woman conceives, it takes 3 to 4 months for that immature egg to go from the center of the ovary to the periphery of the ovary and get expelled through that little follicle that ends up stimulating so much estrogen and progesterone and so forth. But it takes 3 to 4 months for the immature egg to become mature. And what is happening during that time, I talk about this in the book, there's this process of polarization where different organelles in the cell line up in a certain way, in a certain dance. And what I don't talk about in the book, which I will if I do it next time, is the whole meiotic process that's going on, where the chromosomes are lining up in a certain dance, in a very particular dance, and arranging themselves in a very particular dance. That is part of what makes an immature egg mature, is the lining up of things. When the chromosomes don't line up appropriately, you get chromosomal abnormalities, which are responsible for 50% of miscarriages, and are responsible for those eggs being valid eggs or invalid eggs. And there's a woman who is writing a book that should come out soon, and I think it might, I forget, I reviewed it for her, and it's an excellent book in many ways, I think. But she talks about how 70% of eggs end in miscarriage, and 50% of those are because of chromosomal abnormalities. So you can know your cycle, know your timing, know when you're going to get, know when you're fertile, all this kind of stuff. And still, if you've had a poor lifestyle and diet for the last 3 months while this maturation process is happening in the egg, you may not have a viable egg, right? So this woman, and so when we talk about fertility, we focus so much on when you're fertile and when you can get pregnant, but we don't focus on the quality of the egg and how to make that that alignment more smooth, the chromosomal alignment and the maturation process of that egg more smooth. And that's responsible for way more miscarriages than anything else. So why are we not focusing on that? That's a game-changing question in the process of fertility. But the reason I bring it up today is just to talk about, is just to point again at the intelligence of prana, the intelligence of cells. So we see that with the cells that, you know, the white blood cells that leave the vessel, go to a crime scene and come back into the vessel and go along their merry way. We see it in the maturation of a cell like the egg, where going from immature to maturity, the maturation part of that is prana, is the intelligence of the cells, how to line up organelles and chromosomes appropriately. This is tiny, delicate, intricate stuff. And if the prana is supported to be to do this in the right way, we our cells are healthy and we can be healthy. And how do we support that maturation process? You know, how do we support that prana, the intelligence of that prana? Lifestyle, diet. It all goes back to the basics. It goes back to lifestyle and diet and resetting the intelligence of the body through Nadi Shodhana. This is why, I mean, whatever you are doing with Ayurveda, education needs to be part of it, whether it's with single patient after single patient, whether it's getting together with your neighborhood and, you know, building community around this. The way, way, way more important things about the thyroid, about fertility, about anemia, about response to inflammation, about immune response, is the intelligence of the body. And how do we support that? How do we nourish that? And over again, we see it's lifestyle and diet. If you have an appropriate lifestyle and diet for those 3 months before pregnancy, you make a huge impact on the maturity of those eggs, the maturation part of those eggs. Like the woman who wrote this book that I recently reviewed, I think it's called It's All About the Egg, and it should be coming out soon. She herself was going through IVF procedures, and 3 out of 21 or something of her eggs were viable because they weren't maturing right. The chromosomal abnormalities were present in all but 3. And then she changed her lifestyle and diet for 3 months and went through the next IVF cycle, and 18 of her 21 eggs or something were viable in 3 months, changing her lifestyle and diet. So lifestyle and diet affects epigenetics, it affects maturation of cells, and then it's going to affect the health of our children and our offspring. Respecting the intelligence of our cells, respecting the intelligence of our bodies, and helping reset that. So whether we know the ins and outs of all this stuff or not, and all the Western stuff and all the Ayurvedic stuff and all the complicated stuff, there is no more important thing than going back to the basics, than working with lifestyle and diet and alternate nostril breathing and Abhyanga and a little bit of yoga and getting fresh air. It's these are all really, really the most important things. You get that? You get that I'm not just saying that because that's what we mostly have available to us. You get how important that is?
Yeah.
Good. Good. Right. Any other questions? All right. Chrisandra, how's your baby sleeping? Did you try the ghee at night?
Yeah, I have tried the ghee. Not, well, once it was a little bit heavy, I think, for him. Because
mm-hmm.
He kind of vomited it up.
But, how much did you give him?
Like, less than a teaspoon.
Less than a teaspoon of vomit. Okay.
But, you know what, I think it wasn't melty enough.
Yeah, it needs to be melty.
Yeah. And then, but see, then it's like you want to make sure it's not too warm when it's melty.
You do. Right, absolutely.
So, but he's definitely sleeping better. I can't believe how much he's growing. That's the thing.
How much he's growing?
Yeah, like every morning he looks at me. I'm doing the Abhyanga. Or just, you know, doing oil massage with him.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
Yeah.
Well, I hope that continues to go well. It's been such a pleasure to be with all of you. And you too, Dr. Carey, when you get back, and everybody else. And thank you so much for being here. And God willing, our paths will cross again.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
It's my joy.
Yay.
Yeah. All right. So let's take 30 seconds or so to just recalibrate and absorb and shift gears. All right. Thank you, everybody. Till next time.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.